I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. Large and small cities depend on a vibrant downtown to generate revenue, economic growth, housing, quality of life, and a central gathering place for local residents. Shifting industry trends in North Carolina have left many small towns with boarded up downtowns that have been starved of critical investment. This week, I've got Rebecca McGee locked in, who is highly skilled in facing these challenges. She's worked a stint in Lexington, Asheboro, and now in High Point. I want you to lock in to learn the challenges and benefits of revitalizing downtown North Carolina cities. Rebecca, how are you today?
Good. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, thank you for joining me. You and I, we go way back. You've made a sort of a tour across North Carolina, starting out down in Lexington, and then I reconnected with you in Asheboro, and now so thrilled to have you even closer to home here in High Point, working on some of the needs that they have in their downtown. I guess let's start there because you've seen so much. I mean, the idea of revitalizing downtowns is not a new subject in large cities, whether it's Charlotte, who started it back in the 90s, Raleigh in the early 2000s, and then even subsequently communities like Greensboro and Winston, who have done a lot of downtown revitalization. Why is this becoming so critically important in smaller communities?
Well, originally, downtowns were the hub of everything. They were a hub of social interactions. They were the hub of business. It was the hub of where you did your shopping and where you made those social connections. And it was just everything. And then when we saw in the 70s and 80s that businesses were going more toward urban development and toward malls instead of downtown shopping, it kind of really changed the landscape of downtown. So they saw the need, or many communities saw the need, to bring that back downtown. Each city has a unique outlay for their city. Some are, you know, have more residential around them. Some are more of a business and commerce area. And it's super important to bring that core back. So the core goes of your city as to how the rest of it goes. So if you can re-energize that core, it's just going to make a ripple effect through the entire city and community.
You know, I was someone, I can't say I was intimately involved with the revitalization of downtown Winston. I was really just starting my career. I was really blessed to meet a lot of key people who were involved in revitalizing downtown. And I feel like I learned a lot from them and then went on to be able to participate in my own ways. You know, even in a community the size of Winston-Salem or Greensboro, one key element to revitalizing their downtown was convincing people to live there, right? And that was a hard sell, you know, even in cities as large as Greensboro and Winston, you know, obviously in areas like Charlotte, Raleigh, where you've got people migrating into those communities from much larger cities, they're sort of used to that urban style living. I'm looking at a project now in Lexington, and, you know, one of the tough obstacles is, are people in these small communities ready to live downtown? Are they ready to live, work, and play in a downtown? What's been your observation coming from, you know, working in small communities and now ended up in a larger community like High Point?
Well, I live and breathe what I do. I believe wholeheartedly in that. In fact, I have lived in downtown Lexington, and I currently live in downtown Winston. And residents are a key piece that so many downtowns were not focused on for so long because, you know, it's a business community. Let's get more restaurants. Let's get more offices. And they really kind of left out that residential piece. I do see a lot of the people that were in bigger cities coming down to our smaller cities, loving that local community where you can go out at night and you're going to know who's going to sit next to you at that restaurant, or you can see your friend from across the street. It really does build that sense of community. And I believe since 2020 and COVID, what we went through, it really stripped away some of that community, and people then are rushing back to it. So I do believe those small communities are getting an influx of younger people, an influx of even, you know, the baby boomers coming back into downtown, wanting to live in downtown. Pretty much every city I've been in that I see, all say and wish, we think we can support more residential. We wish we had more residential. People will fill those gaps. You have people in my age and generation are saying, we wish we had more options in a downtown community. It's becoming more of a walkability, more of a sustainability model. You know, you don't want that massive acreage to maintain. You want a home, comfortable and easy accessibility to those things. So I see it coming, not just in the big cities, not in major, major areas, but in these small micropolitan areas as well.
You know, I listened to you and what you describe sounds a lot like growth, right? You want to try to grow these downtown areas. You heard me mention earlier, through some of that growth, you end up generating more revenue and there's all these other benefits that can flow. However, there's some residents in town who say, I don't want to see my community grow. I don't want to see things change. I like the fact that, you know, that diner has always been there at the corner of First and Main that I go to every Wednesday and see my friends. How do you balance the needs of the older generation in these communities who are actually very comfortable with the status quo versus their kids, right, who might be demanding some level of change in these downtown areas?
I see it a lot, especially in the smaller communities. And for me, who is looking ever forward, it doesn't mind change. That's exciting to me. It's extremely frustrating. But that is common, especially in the smaller communities. Actually, I found it doesn't matter the size, though. You'll always have those people that have lived there for generations that feel like they have that hold. I want to know that this place will always be here or this place won't change. But if you can get through and say, hey, give me a chance, let's make small steps here, small steps there. And we don't want to change things to change your history. We just want to add to it. And usually what I've found is if you're given the chance, and those community members that were very hesitant to begin with, if you can produce a quality project, a quality influx of business and community where it's not jeopardizing what they want to still continue, but just adding to it, most people have a change of heart. And I've seen that in communities where you're fighting, and you get city council to take a chance on a project, or you get them to take a chance on something, and you can make that change. Usually, you know, there's a couple stragglers here and there, but usually the majority then say, I never thought this was possible, because that's also something you run into is it's not they're so scared of change. It's they can't imagine the change. And so until it's actually facing them, they don't believe they believe it's negative. So it's all about perception and just getting that trust. And that comes, you know, with having those relationships with people downtown.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I always like to say that progress only moves at the speed of trust. And, you know, having that social capital built up inside of the community allows for that community to trust one another and hopefully also grow together and not be so fearful of the new people who might be coming into town, or the people who might want to live a little bit differently, and don't mind actually living downtown, you know, in a high rise apartment property or unit. You know, I continue to be very bullish about what's happening around the state of North Carolina right now. I mean, it just seems like we keep getting big announcement after big announcement, a lot of people, a lot of capital flowing into our state. And, you know, I try to use this conversation to just keep my audience informed about all the great things happening in their backyard. I want to start off with Robbie, because Robbie, you always seem to know what's getting ready to happen before it happens. So, you know, the headlines at least a couple of days in advance. Give us an idea what's going on recently now with the state of the commercial real estate market. Is industrial still on fire?
Well, Algernon, we are on fire. This state is, we're going to have new people move here every day. And North Carolina is really, I think, taking advantage of its positive business climate. We have wonderful infrastructure, wonderful place to live. But I think over the past few years, our elected officials have positioned the state in a way that attracts business to North Carolina. We're always at the top of every national list about recruiting new businesses into the state and capital investment. And that trend was strong in 2022. And we expect to continue the trend in 2023. And particularly in the Piedmont Triad, we've got huge announcements from Toyota and Boom Supersonic and VinFast and, you know, Wolfspeed, all in this Central Carolina core area. It's just a tremendous sea change for the state.
You know, Robbie, I want to dig into a point that you just made. You talked about how North Carolina shows up on all the lists. And I see the various lists, whether it's Forbes and all these various companies to put together lists all around the country. How for my audience that may not really understand the context of how they come up with those lists, how important is that really for North Carolina? How important is it to show up on these national rankings?
Well, when you're showing up with Texas and Georgia and Tennessee and states where you've got a positive business climate, that's the list that you want to be on. And you see the figures of population change around the country, the migration from some of the northeastern or midwestern states to the southeast. And it really is an endorsement of the health of our economy and the way our state's being run. And the positive attitude and can-do attitudes of North Carolinians.
You know, Representative Zinger, it sounds like he's singing your praises. The Republican-led General Assembly has been very, very busy, not just in the latest couple of sessions, but really going back all the way to 2012 when they were awarded the leadership. What's the legislature doing to make sure we keep showing up on these national rankings that Robbie's talking about?
Well, you're absolutely right in terms of what happened. And you go back and you look at where the state was when Republicans took over. We had a tremendous amount of debt. We had all kinds of issues. And we've really worked diligently over these 10 or 12 years to make it business friendly. And we're being rewarded with that. You know, it was just announced the other day, we've got $3.25 billion surplus. That didn't happen by accident. There's a lot of issues out there that we're trying to get in front of. We keep having businesses come. I'm announcing more jobs. But, you know, the issue for us that we're trying to, you had said that Robbie is kind of a living ahead. Well, we're trying to do the same thing. And so two issues that I think are going to be very, very big and are very, very big. One is manpower. And number two is housing. You know, we're going to have, we got a lot of jobs coming here to North Carolina that they need more than a college education, but they don't need a college or more in a high school education, but they don't need a four-year college degree. And so you're going to see the legislature is going to continue to be pushing into the community college system to help us meet those needs that have qualified employees to go in and take these jobs at Boom and Toyota and all these places that are coming. Secondly, you know, one of the things that we're really working on and I'm playing a big part in is trying to figure out how we create more opportunity for housing and affordable housing. Housing has gotten really out of control in terms of the cost. I think the new home construction, basically, you're starting at about $300,000 to get into the market. And so that's a big issue. Also, workforce housing. And so we're trying to be proactive and stay in front of that. The last thing that we need to stay in front of is also energy needs. Our energy, you know, we had 1.5 million people move here in the last 10 years, and they all would like to turn on their lights and, you know, be able to enjoy everything. And so I'm on the Energy Commission, Energy and Utilities Committee this year, and I'm glad to be a part of that. But those are kind of the three big hot button things that we need to do as a legislature to continue to stay in front of the needs that are going to come with all this great growth.
Here in Greensboro, here in our backyard, there's been some big improvements in terms of transportation. What does that mean in terms of job creation and then just to the everyday person?
Well, we're fortunate that we've had our urban loop recently completed within the last 60 days. You can drive 47 miles around Greensboro on an urban loop. And that creates all sorts of opportunities for job growth. For example, I don't think that we would have landed Publix and their 2 million square foot distribution center on the east side of Greensboro without the urban loop. All of that plays into the transportation infrastructure. For example, Publix said that they saved millions of truck miles a year, keeping in mind that they'll have about 1,000 tractor trailers coming to that facility every day, but saving millions of truck miles because of the location close to that loop. And you see that played out dozens of different examples about how businesses can flourish because of connection. The single biggest beneficiary in terms of a geographic area to the Greensboro Urban Loop is probably Rockingham County. You think about the connection down 29 from Reidsville. And that getting to the airport, to Piedmont Triad Airport, that is a huge deal. The connectivity of 73 back up to Madison and Eden is causing an explosion in Rockingham County, in southern Rockingham County. And the same is true as you connect I-74 back down to Randolph County in Asheboro. Mm. You're seeing an explosion in economic growth. So I expect that will continue. Now, we've got to work on getting our water and sewer. As Jeff said, we've got to have water and sewer in these rural areas so that they can take advantage of these transportation arteries. If you can't flush a toilet, certainly can't put a manufacturing plant in.
Yeah, when you look around the region, Robbie, at least to try it specifically, it just feels like Greensboro has sort of stepped out sort of leaps and beyond here. I mean, in terms of the transportation infrastructure, the airport, just some of those kind of infrastructural needs that you have to have as foundational for economic growth. I mean, is it right to say that Greensboro is now the leader in the triad?
I think the triad is the leader in the triad. We're the beneficiary of having three really cool cities, that all of whom are putting large dollars into their central business areas to make them cool and neat. So you got to have the transportation, you got to have the water and sewer, but you've got to have a place that people think are cool, because that's what differentiates you from your competition. And if you've got a great place to eat in downtown, a place that you can go to a show, street festivals, ballparks, And we've got them all in Winston-Salem, Greensboro, and High Point. It increases the quality of life in an area. And that's what folks are looking for. Yes, they're making good money in their jobs, but when they're off, they want to enjoy themselves. And they want to spend some of that money. And we're set up to for that. People are used to, in the areas that we're competing with, they're used to first class entertainment venues, and we've got to match it here along with the transportation.
You know, Ramsey over at Triad Business Bank, I mean, you guys are covering the whole region. I mean, what are your thoughts right now when you look at Winston, Greensboro, High Point in comparison to one another? Not necessarily trying to create that competition, but do you see a clear leader, or is it more balanced?
I think Robbie's spot on in terms of the entire area is on fire. We looked at some data, and we're commissioned to do it again in 2023, but we looked at 2019 and 2021 in terms of the businesses and the growth in businesses. And, we've historically had kind of an aging market where the textile, the furniture, the manufacturing, the tobacco industry have given up a lot of jobs over years. But we actually saw a strong growth in the businesses, and it's happening in the small businesses. We got about 10,500 businesses in the three cities and the surrounding area. About 1.2 million of the 1.7 million people in the whole Piedmont Triad, about 1.2 million live in these two counties, and specifically in the three cities in the surrounding area. And in those areas, we saw 300 new businesses kind of enter that we went from about 10,200 to 10,500 businesses. Now, they are predominantly the smaller size businesses. So this study we did commissioned, it looked at revenue per business. And so predominantly the growth is in the 1 to 5 million sales businesses. But what's so exciting about what you led off your show is, for the first time, we're starting to see some of these larger businesses with Toyota and Boom Jet, and you were mentioning the battery company that's expanding. We're starting to see some larger businesses, and it'll be interesting to see if that growth, holds up in that area, because that'll change sort of the the top line growth number in jobs, you know, much quicker than as it's, you know, these green shoots have been primarily on the small businesses evolving. And that's the lifeblood of our economy, is those small businesses.
Right.
If we can marry that up with growth in the larger businesses, you know, then I think we're going to see the same kind of economic demographics that we see out of Charlotte and Raleigh and down into Charleston. I think you're seeing those same kind of, you know, leading of the nation type of growth rates.
You know, the National Association of Realtors has been in existence for over 116 years. We are an organization that has been there for the consumer. We make sure that we are paying attention to advocacy and the representation of our clients, both sellers and buyers across the nation. And when it came to the proposed settlement, as it was addressed more than a little over 3 weeks now, we realized quickly some states are going to have a little bit more work to do and other states are not going to have as much work to do because they're already doing some of these things. But it was more about the confusion that needed to be corrected talking about compensation. Everybody was throwing a number out there that there was a certain type of compensation that was there, and because that was no longer going to be, it was going to make pricing or our properties more affordable. Well, that's the misconception there. We have always had a part of compensation for our professional service that was negotiable. It's never not been negotiable. And, you know, the market dictates what the property values are. So the market tells us what property should be valued at. It's not necessarily what the compensation that's being paid for a professional service, but it's the market in the marketplace from California to North Carolina to Chicago that it's going to say what a property should be priced at and what it's going to sell for. So that's the misconception that's out there that we're trying to clearly redefine, because it's not about that the property values are going to drop. It's just about, more about, as we talked about, the way that we're communicating what that compensation is when we're talking to our sellers and to our buyers.
Yeah, just the procedure around how you talk about the compensation has made the major change. But the price of a home will continue to be largely dictated by whatever's happening in your market. And as we know, the age-old saying with housing and real estate in general is location, location, location. That tends to drive the price, as much as also supply and demand is something I keep trying to remind folks of. You know, a lot of times when you see prices, whether it be on the price of a home or the price of an egg, that price is actually indicating something different. It's indicating the fact that supply might either be tight or there may be an oversupply. And so obviously prices drop in that scenario.
And if you're talking about price specifically, if we look at coming out of COVID, really where the pricing got higher is, you know, we had a limited inventory. The selling market in 2021 and 2022, which we never thought would have been coming out of a COVID state, was a frenzy because we had such low interest rates. And so people were just wanting to be out in the market. And so there was limited inventory. And as that interest rate started to increase to what it should have been as a normal rate, it came across as being a higher rate to some that maybe had not been in the market. And so less people were putting their house on the market because they were realizing that they had benefited from that 2% and 3% that could have been there. And so as we know that the interest rates are going to come back down a little bit more in the very short term, probably by mid-year of this year, we're starting to see more inventory come back on the market. And so there's that frenzy because there's not enough inventory and everybody wants to get in. So the property values are going up a little bit.
Yeah. And I'd like to also remind people, some of us have short memories, but if you go back to 2009, which was the start of what became known as the Great Recession, we stopped building houses after the Great Recession. We stopped developing lots. And so when the market demand spiked, there really wasn't a lot of supply out there because we hadn't been building any houses or developing any subdivisions. And so there was a lot of catch up that needed to happen, which I think also exacerbated pricing as well. You know, for some of us who may not pay as close of attention to all these issues, they may not be in the weeds on it the way you and I are, Tony. You know, you stated the National Association of Realtors has been in existence for 116 years. The way you all get compensated, that particular practice has been around decades, if not a century. What changed now? What was this lawsuit, or what happened recently that all of a sudden caused or triggered this change that we're seeing now?
So what precipitated this was a few years ago, there was a seller-initiated, consumer-based lawsuit that stated that they felt like that the fact that the seller had to pay compensation to a buyer's agent unnaturally inflated the listing agent, the price of the property. And so through the course of that lawsuit, the settlement that came out of that, or the proposed settlement that's actually on the table now, states that they recommend for us to take the compensation agreement that we have in the multiple listing service away. Where we have always enjoyed good transparency and making sure that when a listing is done on a property, the listing agent within, with an agreement with the seller, would place in the multiple listing service what that compensation was to a buyer's agent. It was good, easy communication. It was offered in an open setting. The proposed settlement, one of the four things from the proposed settlement states that they want that removed. They want the compensation portion out of the multiple listing service removed. That could be from if you were actually marketing a rental property, a condo, townhome, single family residence, land, any compensation in any form is to be removed from the multiple listing service. And so what that means is that the way that we as realtors communicate what compensation is going to be on both sides is going to be done differently. So we're in that, we're trying to now figure out what is going to be the normal course of business for us to be able to communicate that.
Was the when you talk about the compensation being removed from the MLS or the multiple listing service, as you described, was the concern that by it being listed there, certain realtors might have been pushing deals in one direction or the other? Is that where the concern was coming from? Or
No. And even we as realtors, I think it's important to bear to your listener that there's a difference between what a real estate agent is in the state of North Carolina and even across the nation. You know, when a licensee decides to get a real estate license, they go and they take their tests and they pass their tests. And of course, they become a real estate agent. In the state of North Carolina, we're brokers. We're a broker state. And if you take one level step higher and you become a realtor, which is an independent organization that actually is a trade organization, we're bound and held to a higher ethical standard. And so we have a code of ethics, and our code of ethics bound us higher and even larger than state law. Part of those code of ethics tell us that we need to make sure that we are being transparent with our clients and customers and consumers when it comes to the way that we're working in relationships with them. So we have not only seller agency where we're actually listing a property, but we also have buyer agency in North Carolina. That is the difference from most of the states across the United States. We're one of 18 states that actually has buyer agency and actually has had that for the past 20 plus years. So we are very fortunate that some of the changes that they're actually asking for in the proposed settlement, we in North Carolina have already been doing. And so it's just a matter of a couple of technical changes and a couple of the ways that we're communicating differently that we're actually going to be changing. North Carolina actually is in really good shape.
That's actually very good to hear. I mean, it sounds like we've already been a leader going in the direction of where the entire country will now be going. Why do you think North Carolina was so progressive on that? I mean, you say it's us and 17 other states. What triggered that, I guess, many years ago? It's not like you said we've been doing this for what, 10 years or
20 years or so? 20 years. I could be off a year or so, but you know, our realtors and our agents within the state of North Carolina really saw a value in making sure that all parties in a transaction had an agency relationship. You know, when I go and I meet with a buyer client, I want to sit down with them and I want to be transparent and be their educator and their facilitator in this transaction. And I want them to have the relationship with me. And so to do that, we have agency agreement. And so there's good transparency in conversation. And it really allows me to tell my client exactly what I'm going to do for them and how I'm going to help them through, for the most part, one of the largest financial transactions that our clients will ever do. So we make sure that on both the selling side and on the buyer side, both parties are represented. And we do that through contractual paperwork.
Now, I know in my own investment banking practice, and, you know, obviously I've got many in my audience, too, that also focus on commercial real estate. Maybe they might be investors, developers, or even brokers. What kind of changes can we see within the commercial real estate space, if any?
I don't know that you're going to see any change. The commercial practitioners have actually been doing this. I won't say that all, but some commercial properties have been listed in other formats. They haven't necessarily been in a multiple listing service. And so compensation discussions and the way that they've been doing compensation between their commercial practitioner to another commercial practitioner has been the way that the proposed settlement is asking for. And so they have already been doing this. It's the residential side that we've actually used more of the multiple listing service system. And so there's a little bit of a transition that we're going to go through with that. And so we're still working out the logistics for that right now.
And then if I also understand you, I mean, you did a great job of highlighting the difference between what we know as a realtor, which, again, I think most of us, including myself, as close as I am to the industry, I sort of thought that everyone was just a realtor. But you did a great job of highlighting the fact that everyone's not a realtor. They may be an agent. And if they are a realtor, then that means they've made the extra commitment to actually be a part of the National Association of Realtors. They're adhering to a higher standard. So with all the other folks out there who might not be considered a realtor, who may not even use the MLS, what kind of changes could we expect to see just amongst those pool of what you call agents?
Well, you know, if you take the code of ethics away and you remove the realtor branding, then you have your licensures or your licensees for the state. And so the North Carolina Real Estate Commission really governs law dealing with how real estate agents work within the state of North Carolina. And in fact, just a few minutes ago, I was on a call with them as they're addressing this issue and how their laws change, if not any, because they're actually doing also what the proposed settlement is requesting as well. There's really no rule change for the North Carolina Real Estate Commission and licensures across the state or licensees across the state versus the Realtor brand. The Realtor brand is just adding another layer of education, awareness, and advocacy along with the code of ethics that we actually abide by that's a level above.
I see. So there may, at least for the folks that are not part of the association, they may continue to do things however they want to do it. Because, I mean, if you're an agent and not a realtor, are you actually using the MLS? Do you have access to it? Or
It depends on how the multiple listing service is set up. There may be some that you could join that way. By most, you are a realtor member when you are part of a local association.
Yeah, we're looking at a point in time right now where technology has been moving at a faster. Coming out of the internet age, I thought that was about the fastest we would see technology move. But I have been proven wrong, and it's moving even faster as we look around and see the advent of ChatGPT and AI and you know, chat bots and all these things that are being created. Is the National Association of Realtors, is there any concern that at some point we get to the point where if I want to buy a house, I just log onto a website and I deal with a virtual realtor and it's artificial intelligence that's actually guiding me through the process?
Well, technology, we've got to embrace it. And if you don't embrace it, it's going to pass you by. And so we have all tried to figure out how technology is going to work in our favor in this industry. You know, ultimately, as we survey our members from not only the national level, but a local and state level, and we talk to our consumers about that, ultimately, they want somebody that is boots on the ground. I don't think that our clients and customers and consumers really are comfortable with a total virtual product. The ability for our buyers and sellers to be able to go online and to be able to see properties is a great thing. It's a transparency thing. It's an open market so people actually can see what's available. But when it comes to actually doing that transaction and having somebody that knows the market, that knows the ins and outs of purchasing a property, the financing, the inspections, the what ifs that could take place course of a transaction, having that realtor that's highly professional, connected, and educated is always going to be the sense of what we're going to need or what the consumer is going to need during the transaction. And that's what they feel comfortable with, is having that boots on the ground person to guide them through that process.
And I would remind my audience, I mean, everybody that knows me, Tony, you and I are new friends, so we're just getting to know each other. But if you've known me for an extended period of time, you know that I'm a huge advocate of supporting locally owned businesses. You know, that AI chatbot doesn't go to your church, or you won't run into that virtual realtor at the grocery store, and other things. But, you know, that local realtor, not only is it boots on the ground and somebody you can engage with that can give you good information, but you're also supporting a locally owned business. That realtor probably has a family, maybe their kids go to school with your kids. So I do think that, you know, I don't think, you know, I agree with you, Tony. I don't think we'll be able to stop the progress of technology. I mean, it's going to be what it is. But I do think as we continue to see the rollout of more and more technology, more artificial intelligence, we've got to remind people that, you know, by supporting a real person, you are supporting local, you are supporting your community, and that person is a member of that community with you. So let's keep that in mind.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.